Welcome to All Road 65 Max Radio, where the road ahead gets brighter as we journey towards truth, traveling through our dreams and an inspiration into a new reality. It's time, and your ticket is waiting. All Roads Lead 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson.
Greetings, and thank you for joining me on BBS Radio, All Roads 65 Max Radio. I am your host, Pamela L. Henderson. My focus is my mission statement, to help create a quality of life through social growth, inspiring Jews to become leaders by establishing partnerships with entrepreneurs, corporations, donors, sponsors, volunteers, the community, and abroad. Please join me every other Tuesday at noon on BBS Radio. And also, follow me at Quora.com/Pamela L. Space. My special guest today is Mr. Etney, judge, lawyer, and author. We're going to discuss his intriguing children's and bedtime stories for clever kids. He inserts that our young ones are clever, and we should give them the credit that they deserve. His writing and illustrations open up conversations to complex issues as freedom, self-worth, tolerance, and the environment. The amusing stories and characters within will entertain readers while at the same time drawing out their thoughts on these important issues. At last, I want to say thank you so much for joining me on the show. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Pamela. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege.
Yes, sir. So tell me a little bit about you. I see that I'm so honored myself. I thank you so much. This is my third judge to join me. And the conversations have been so intriguing, and especially reading about you. I mean, I was just totally fascinated, and I love about the children books and everything. So we're going to talk all about that. But where are you located, and how's the weather?
Well, my name is Etienne Lebuskagni. I am based in Pretoria in South Africa. Okay. It's sweltering outside. It's 10 o'clock at night and still probably just short of 30 degrees Celsius outside. So
Wow. If
you're in a cooler climb, count your blessings.
Really? I can't wait to come and visit South Africa. I'm very excited of doing so.
You will love it. It's very diverse and very enriching.
Really? Okay, yes. That's what I hear. So that's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
So I'm going to get right to it. I have a bunch of questions, and I'm so excited again, I must say. So let me ask you my first question. Everyone has a why. Like, I am a mentor and a leader, and my why for me giving back to my community and abroad is because, for one, I'm an empath. Two, I believe that as a woman and a girl growing up, if I had the resources that were needed, I can dance amongst the stars. And even though I have a story pertaining to why I had established my foundation, I've come to find that 85% of young girls, we can help. And it's only 15% that we can't. And that's due to drugs and alcohol and domestic violence, which my heart goes out to other young girls and women. And that's the reason why I established my foundation, because everything we do is all about customer service skills, getting angry, how we deal with people, communicating, all of that. And I felt that since that was my expertise, because I come from the corporate world and in management, hospitality, why not give that back to them so they can understand there is a better choice and a better life for them moving forward into social growth? So can you tell me your why? Why you enjoy empowering and created the children books and strongly encourages objective learning?
Well, I think I took quite a long time to be trained and taught and to be shaped. And as a father, I remember the impact of my children in shaping me. And as a professional lawyer, I felt that I was privileged to be exposed to so many interesting matters that I felt obliged to use that professional training also to mentor other aspiring advocates to bring them into a realm into which they might not be otherwise because of a disadvantaged background or whatever. So I felt the need to plow back what I had received professionally. And once I'd raised my children, the thought of grandchildren was a very enticing thought. And it was in 2017 when my wife suddenly died. And the thought of grandchildren was a lifeline. It was a way of trying to cast a hook into the future and to have something to hang on to. And I started writing these stories to grandchildren that I didn't know whether I would ever see them. And it was a way of having my voice heard in their lives in case I didn't make it until they arrived. So this was a continuing process of wanting to transfer what I have received. And a lot of what I am focused on as far as children are concerned is to have them feel good about themselves.
Right.
To validate them and to give them skills to deal with moments of adversity and to prepare them for it in a way where they might be given the skills without having gone through the trauma. And these stories were therefore born of a progression of wanting to give back. My position as a judge is very much the same thing. It's by my time to give back and to try and shape our democracy in a way that brings honor to its people and builds the constitutional values and the fundamental rights that we all share into daily life. That's a very different level of plowing back. But as far as children are concerned, I have a very soft spot for them. And right. I revel in the thought of entertaining them at bedtime. And during COVID, it was a time, we all remember it. It was a bizarre season for all of us, suddenly being locked down
right.
in our homes. And I felt a great deal of empathy for parents with young children being locked up in apartments for days on end. I can just imagine, what do you do next to keep these children busy?
Right.
And my stories I wrote at that time, I felt driven. I've got to give these parents a break. And I wrote these stories and I disseminated them for free on social media. I just sent them to everybody I knew who had children. I told them, just send them to everybody else who has children. You deserve at least a 5-minute break at bedtime, and this story will give it to you.
Wow, that's beautiful. That is beautiful. My Sue, when we discuss about children, I tell you, Judge, my heart just like melts. I mean, I can't do everything, but I tell you, I'm the type of person I sure will try. I mean, when I see someone suffering, young teenagers that, you know, how they sell certain things like when they're trying to play basketball or, you know, sports and they have to sell their candies and everything. And I just try. It doesn't matter. I don't care if I even have a dollar. I just give that because it is important. They are clever and we do need to give them that recognition. So thank you so much for stating that. You are a high court judge from South Africa who has had your writings published in regarding your book, Bedtime Stories for Clever Kids. I know you've been touching a little bit about that, but I'm still, the questions are still may seem like I'm asking a little bit of the same questions, but they're not. So
Ask them
can
anyway.
you, that's right. So tell me how you came up with the title of the book of being Clever Kid, Clever Kids.
You know, I attended a course at one stage on writing for children. And the theme that emerged was that when you write for children, it's like writing for adults, only better. And it means that when you write, the words must be shorn of all unnecessary content and must be focused. And in the process of me trying to write to children, I found a resistance to the thought of talking down to them. I didn't want to speak down to them. I wanted to speak to them. And I wanted them to realize that I'm interested in them. I'm not here just as a teacher trying to insert into their minds thoughts that they might not have had before. I actually, when it comes to bedtime, I'm very much interested in firstly entertaining them and then introducing with a light hand certain topics. And as I started writing my stories, I realized that they're not the common type of story. There are very different layers that just emerge, might be the way my mind thinks. But in the process of writing these stories and entertaining them and throwing in side jokes, firstly to entertain myself and to entertain the parents,
Right.
I realized that I'm triggering all sorts of side alleys and bringing into the narrative a multitude of different concepts, which in the end build up to a story which is not your usual single thought carried through over 6 or 8 pages. There's more to it. And I realize that I'm actually busy conveying more than just story. And in the process, I also realize that these thoughts, if I were to go back to the teacher of the course that I attended to, she would say, "But you're writing over their heads." And I realize I'm not. I'm busy introducing in bite sizes something that they can digest, but it will speak to them as something bigger and trigger thoughts. So simple parables are utilized to introduce profound thoughts. But in children, I realize that they still have a lot to learn. So I don't try and resolve everything.
Right.
I'm introducing a topic and hoping the parents will take it further. And so the concepts are complex, but the delivery and the presentation is light. And it's fun.
That's right. Tell me how you finally got to follow your childhood passion to paint and illustrate books.
Oh, that was that came about when I was about 12. We had relocated to a city, and I was living in an apartment on the beach, admittedly, which was lovely. But my parents were shopkeepers, and I could never go anywhere during holidays because there was nowhere to go. My parents had business hours to keep, so it was me in the apartment. And a very kind neighbor who painted, she said, "Well, I want to show you something." And I found I have a knack for it. And that spawned a hobby, which has stayed with me since then. And in fact, I paint almost daily. It's a form of therapy for me. It's a form of accounting for what I see because I see beauty, and something in me wants to record it. And I'm not, I don't try and create masterpieces. I see myself as an impressionist. So I want to catch that fleeting moment that caught my eye. And it will be there to remind me of this moment of beauty in a day which might have been drab. In other senses, and in the process of painting, there's a lot of unloading of tensions. Your mind is racing, and you are running. And in the field in which I practice, there's a lot of stress. It's an adversarial profession. You're forever dealing with people at one another's throats, and the managing of that process is in itself filled with stress. So art was a way of diffusing and accounting, because my eye was never, it doesn't go dull during the day. As a lawyer, I still see the beauty around me. I still am in wonder at the play of light on objects and the play of light on people's faces. So the painting was in a sense almost a type of journaling, but it had very good spin-offs, because as a lawyer, I found that the art, the utilization of the skills of trying to bring a big scene into focus through brushstrokes, you of necessity have to start big. You are focusing in on what matters, and you end up with the detail. And that process, that art of reduction, is what advocacy is. When you're a litigator, you have an array of facts, many of which are not relevant, but you will paint in the relevant bits that will take the judge to the point that you are trying to sell to him. And that creative process of painting, taught me to think out of the box as a lawyer. And that meant
Absolutely.
as well that I could package presentation of arguments in a way using words as instruments of art to convey meaning. And very much in the same way where you would use paint and skill to convey light and to convey a visual message, I'm just conveying a word image using very much the same skills, but I found that I was enriched as a lawyer through the art. Not the other
Wow.
way around, I'm
Right.
afraid. Lawyers are
Yeah,
very, very analytical. And if you think your analytical skill is going to make you a good artist, it will turn you into a very boring one.
really.
I think too much detail kills. You've got to
True.
preserve the life. And that means you have to have a light touch.
Wow. So, do you raise issues? Okay, from reading about you and doing my research, you do raise issues of freedom, self-worth, tolerance, and environment in your stories.
That's right, yes.
Why are they the main focus in the stories for children?
I think the concept of freedom, which is in the very first story, is the
Okay.
story of my country. It wasn't a deliberate choice to make it the first story, but I felt that children need to understand what it is to be free. Having grown up under an oppressive regime of where I was on the privileged side, I realized only in my adulthood what it meant for people not to be free, for people who looked different to me, who had a different life experience, and who felt, although they were physically able to move about, the impairment of their rights, etc., somehow constrained their humanity. And that to me was a killing of a spark. Right. And I wanted to show children in a very simple story that freedom has different forms. And I'm not talking about political freedom in the story. I'm trying to persuade, to tell children that freedom has different forms. You can have a bird in a cage and feel sorry for it.
Right.
But you could also be the bird in the cage thinking I'm safe.
And that's what gives you freedom.
That's a different perspective. He doesn't see the cage as limiting. The cage is protection.
Right.
You can have a parrot with clipped wings sitting on somebody's shoulder and think, but that bird is not free because it can't fly. But the reality might be that that bird, if it could fly, would not be able to care for itself. And in this particular story, there's a beautiful love relationship between the parrot and the owner. They are company to one another. They need one another. So in that sense, although the bird cannot fly, it is still free. You see a circus elephant who grew up as a young elephant tied to a little post. And as a young elephant, found he couldn't get away from this tether, and as an adult is still trapped in that mindset that he's not free, while he could just flick it away. He's forgotten how to be free. And then comes the crunch, bring it to a child in a wheelchair. This girl sees a child in a wheelchair and thinks shame, but then sees this girl as being pushed by her father through a parking lot, and they are doing jumps over all the speed bumps, and she is screaming in delight. Her dad is running, and they are racing, and they have the time of their life. And she realized, but for that girl, that chair is not her prison. That chair is her chariot.
Right.
She's having fun. So you have, this is a one story introducing very different types of freedom into the fold, and the idea, it's summarized here, and just I can just read you a few lines,
please.
And this girl, Kai is her name. She thinks a wheelchair is like a cage. But that girl has turned it into her racehorse. She is full of life. She is free. And then she asks her mother, Mommy, what does it mean to be free? What do you think it means? Answers her mom. She says, I'm confused. Sometimes a cage isn't a cage. And sometimes the only cage is in your mind.
Wow.
So now, this is something, and obviously her mother then rewards her with ice cream. She says, you already know a lot about freedom, it seems. But just through observation of a few things, a simple topic has been given different layers. And those aren't, they are relevant for a child to think that I must not be imprisoned. I must be free in my mind. And if I'm not free in my body, I can still be free. as long as I'm free in my mind. It's to empower a child to embrace liberty and the joy that it brings.
Absolutely agree. I talk about that in my forum when I'm sitting down with my girls. And, you know, racism, it just always the main subject. And we all know that it exists. But yes. I do feel it should not be just part of the daily life. I think racism, we deal with it as it presents itself and puts it in place. And I'm an advocate of believing that I am not enslaved. I'm not in bondage. And I don't have to conform to any organization that establishes slavery.
Yes.
And with that, I have opportunities just like everyone else. So I really and truly, from my heart, that's what I advocate. Because we cannot continue to say, oh, we're enslaved and this has happened. And I'm not saying that it never happened. But what I am saying, we have to put in our minds so we can move forward into social growth that I'm not a slave. So I really appreciate you really speaking about that, because that is something that's dear to all of us. And even though we're dealing with all different kind of things right now in the world, and I don't believe that even with slavery is not in one culture. Slavery is amongst all cultures.
You will find it often within the same culture.
Absolutely.
People looking down at class systems, you find various systems where people are entrapped within cages created in the minds of others. You may not exceed a certain levels or rise above certain horizons. It's like other people are trying to write your life story, and I just don't fall for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree. Tell me about your experience. I know you touched on it a little bit, but growing up in South Africa during the apartheid.
Yes, yes.
You know, I read that, right?
I was, yes. I was born in the year in which South Africa declared its independence unilaterally from Britain, broke away from the Commonwealth, and embarked on its solo journey of apartheid. It was an environment into which I was born. But I only realized later on what it deprived me of. My father was, before he became a businessman, he was in agriculture and in the sugarcane industry. And on the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal, sugarcane is the name of the game. And it's a wonderfully diverse area. As far as the local population is concerned, mostly Zulu. But as far as the farmers were concerned, they were French who came in from Mauritius. They were German areas. And it was a real mixing pot of different cultures. But my brother and sister, for example, on the farm in which we lived, they had exposure to the local black children and learned to speak Zulu. I was just a baby, and we moved away into another farming area, which was then segregated. And I was never exposed to these black children. Now, what a waste. My sister lives in Canada speaking Zulu. My brother lives in Australia speaking Zulu. I live in South Africa with a very limited skill in the language, which I would dearly love to speak fluently. But I was never exposed to it at that as a young child, because I was separated from children who spoke the language. We didn't go to the same schools, lived in different townships. And that system created these bubbles of idiocy where you would never, your life was never enriched through exposure to people of different cultures. I was at high school when, for the very first time, the Rotary Club, which is a charity organization, arranged a leadership course for many of the schools in Durban, where I was at school at that time. And I was exposed to children my age from all racial groups on an equal level socially, can you believe it, for the very first time. Really? I was about 60. It's bizarre to think that we were living in the same country, living lives so independent from one another that I didn't know how their lives looked. And it was an eye-opener to realize just how different their experience is to mine, how innately unfair it is. And the problem was that information was usually filtered, and that happens in this type of society. Information is filtered in a way that you don't get the full picture. Information is censored, and at university, it was as though my eyes went open when I suddenly realized what a load of rot it all was. I remember very clearly a debate between Ted Koppel, an American talk show host who came to South Africa to do interviews. And he had two South Africans interviewing. One was a man called Percy Kroboza, who was an editor of a black newspaper, and Otto Krauser, who was a journalist with an English newspaper. And they were going at one another during the debate. And I picked up on this terrible acrimony. And I heard the next day Ted Koppel saying that he was so saddened after the interview had taken place when Mr. Krauser invited Mr. Kroboza after the interview to say, let's go and have a drink. And Kroboza said to him, I hope you choke. And that, I can remember that as a moment, clear as daylight, when I realized just what deep resentment the system had built into black people, how innately unfair it was, where we were given the sugar-coated version, and I was suddenly faced with the reality that this is a system that needs to be broken down.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it took a long time. I was a babe in the woods for so long, much too long. But so I felt clueless in a sense. You're a child. You go where you're told to be. And you live and you go to school where you're told to be. And in the process, you're deprived of so much interaction, which, thank God, is no longer the case. I mean, our country is a very different place today compared to what it was, largely through schooling. These children are being exposed to one another, particularly in the cities, in a way which I think is natural, where friendships are formed. There was initially a language barrier, and that is changing largely. My home language is Afrikaans, and the lingua franca, which is now developing throughout the country, is English, and it's becoming the main medium of education in state schools. And these children understand each other, at least, whereas 30 years ago, a child from the rural areas would not be able to speak English properly. And they would have difficulty communicating with one another in a normal way. These are just children. Now, I think at the level, the school, the playing fields have been leveled greatly. there's a much more natural interaction between children. And I think that we are getting the benefits of a cohesion, which I thought is difficult to build.
Okay.
When you have such a massive diversity of backgrounds, cultures, languages, expectations, levels of wealth, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Not true. You know, it was like an experiment in this social a social experiment in South Africa during the World Soccer World Cup, something not probably too well known in the US.
Right.
But in 2010, for a whole month, the World Cup was in South Africa. And FIFA as a body, I mean, it was almost like a foreign takeover. They changed laws, etc. And suddenly, it was just soccer for a whole month. And suddenly, it's as though politics disappeared. And for a whole month, we were just people following the soccer and cheering for teams we'd never heard of. Cheering for Georgia, many people won't know where is Georgia, but going to a soccer game and cheering them playing against Czechoslovakia in some place in Africa and getting excited over the game and talking about it. And there was a camaraderie which was fostered in that time, which told us as South Africans that we really actually like each other. If we can just get the politicians out of the way, those who are trying to sow divisive seeds. On a personal level, people are just people and they want the same things for themselves, for the country, for their children. And if you recognize that same vision in someone else, that person is easy to talk to.
Oh, sure.
And that was the wonderful legacy of something like that. There was a cohesion that had formed in those times since 1994, which I thought was quite heartening, and it gives me great hope for this country. It's an amazing place with amazing people, diverse as you could imagine, with some of the greatest challenges you could imagine. But somehow people are go-getters, they fix things, and there's no task too big to tackle.
So tell me, how do you separate being a judge and a lawyer? Have you ever taken, like, been in a situation where you find yourself doing both at one time?
Look, I'm trained as a lawyer, and as a judge, I'm applying the skills that I've learned as an advocate. I was at the bar for 36 years.
Okay.
And the difference between the two is that when you are a litigator, which is what an advocate is, you're trying to sell one half of the case to the judge. And that means that you have to hone your skills on that part which is best for your client. Whereas the skill is very different when you are presiding.
Okay.
Because there you are listening to both sides and you don't have the agenda of trying to make your client win. You are sitting to decide what's right. And that, so as a judge, you obviously need to have a better oversight. You need the skills to recognize what's happening in front of you. And you need to understand what the implications are of what's happening in front of you. But to judge is a very different skill than to advocate a specific case. So being a lawyer is to try and advocate. Being a judge is to assess who's right. And that is a skill which I enjoy utilizing, and I think experience helps you to assess what's right and what's wrong.
Yes, thank you so much for explaining that. I was reading about you, and I was reading your bio. You were the lawyer who was penning children's stories and handing them out to parents of young children for free.
That's right.
I admire that. During the pandemic.
That's right.
Think about that.
Yes, I wrote stories as a on a regular basis. I mean, the 11 that you have in this particular book, some of them saw the light of day during that time. Yes, just as a little footnote, there are dozens of others which are already written and illustrated, but they were a focus point for me to use my time for good. And at a time when we all really needed a bit of good news and a brief respite from the difficulties of keeping young children occupied in times particularly of hard lockdown. So that was something which I enjoyed. I don't write these stories to become rich. I do them in order to enrich. I'd rather have other people get the benefit of the message or the theme, etc., than to coin in on the stories themselves. Yeah, that's really not the focus.
Right. How can children's stories can spur on conversations between a child and a parent, in your opinion?
I think children just need a cue. And something, if it's a cue that interests them, they'll grab the topic and run with it. And you often just need to spark their interest. If you, for example, are walking with your child and you are next to a polluted river, it's something that the child sees. It sees the rubbish lying around. It sees the bad quality, the scum. Speaking about the environment is like something that it's there just for the taking. Talk to your child about why that's bad and why we need to throw our litter into the bin and not throw it into the river because it will kill fish. It's a topic that's so easily introduced just through visual observation. You don't need to have to go and compile a list of themes of what's most important to convey. You can really just walk with your child through the park and what's important will be revealed. You see someone treating a dog cruelly. There's a theme. Talk about it. You see a parent speaking lovingly to a child who is disabled. There's a theme. Just simple kindness. You don't have to look far for high-level themes to be part of a child's visual perceptions on a daily basis. So I think it comes naturally in a sense that I'm really just imparting little snippets of life without trying to make it sound highfalutin. But in the process of sharing those snippets of life, you always realize that there are layers to everything and there are deeper things that you want to bring out in your story. With it might be a superficial thing like just tolerance, but tolerance is just a word. To demonstrate why it's bad, it might be necessary to use an example that for a child that might be upsetting. They might see intolerance. They might see racism. They might see the people judging others in a way that denigrates. Now, that's something that really gets my hackles up. You should free people with your words, not put them in prison. You should build. And if you use your words, and social media is an example where some people relish the platform to trash other people.
Yes.
And it's a form of bullying which I think needs to be dealt with quite strongly. You need to teach children how to be resilient in the face of bullying, wherever it appears, cyberbullying in particular. It can be devastating. I mean, you know, children commit suicide with what people say to them on social media. They think suddenly that that judgment that has been pronounced on them is valid. Somehow they take it on board and say, I have no right to live. What a dreadful message to try and convey. Now I'm slightly off topic now, but it just indicates to you that you just need to see something and it will trigger a thought. And that thought is usually something profound, which you can share with a child in a way that they can take it on board and learn something from it.
So true. So true. And you touched bases on a little bit about it. And that was my next question, because you said good children's stories need to teach, amuse, enlighten, and inspire.
That's right.
Young minds. I want you to elaborate a little bit about that, because I was really intrigued with that statement that you made. And it is so true. That's everything, because what we're taught being young can follow us for the rest of our lives if it is illustrated correctly.
That is so. And the reason why I think that my book at bedtime speaks about a special time is because particularly words that parents speak to their children are received as high authority.
Mm-hmm.
And those words can build or they can break. And I think as a parent, it is important to realize that you cannot unsay things that you said in anger. And your words must therefore be words that uplift. You need to place a guard before your mouth, particularly when it comes to children, because they are so receptive. And particularly from coming from parents, those words can linger for a lifetime. I think the stories that I write, I hope, will be instruments in the hands of parents to try and steer children on the right course. Not in a heavy-handed way, because it is supposed to be a fun time. It and the stories are fun, and make no doubt mm-hmm. of it. But it's from a didactic perspective, it's one of the most serious moments that you can have, because your child is receptive at bedtime.
Right.
Usually they're tired.
So true.
And if your child is receptive, that's the time to build jewels into them. And this hopefully is an instrument to help parents just to drop little pennies, drop little
nuggets,
little gems into children's lives that will grow in time.
And, so true. And, In your book, you discuss dialogues regards to morale, characters with some humor. I like that. And fun that would encourage meaningful and loving conversations between a child and a parent. That is life-changing. What makes that life-changing, in your opinion?
I think affirmation is an important thing. A child who feels affirmed by a parent becomes a confident child. And words of affirmation, I think they're perhaps not spoken intentionally enough by parents. If I can just use a little story.
Okay.
I wrote one of these stories is about Pippin the ostrich. Now, this little story is about breaking through barriers, about conquering fear. Now, it sounds odd, but first of all, an ostrich and egg is very snug, but that becomes a very uncomfortable home if you're growing and growing and the egg becomes too small. And to hatch is a breaking through of a barrier.
Right.
Now breaking through the barrier and suddenly being exposed to light is being exposed to a new world. It's a place full of wonder. It's a place full of danger, and you're not prepared for it. And that's why parenting is so important, to give a child that sense of security. In this little story, the ostrich is now hatched, and then he sees his mother doing the odd thing. She swallows a stone. And then she swallows another one. And he says to her, "Mommy, but those must taste terrible." And she says to him, "I have to swallow them because they help digestion for an ostrich. They mash up our food. It might not be nice. It looks like a bad thing. But there's good that comes out of it." And then the ostrich says, "Well, someday I'm going to have to swallow a stone. I know that. I'm not quite ready for it yet, but something good is going to come out of it."
Right.
and then something interesting happens. An eagle flies over, and suddenly there's fear. And she gathers her chicks under her arms. And the chick then asks his mother, and she says, why is this eagle around? He says, he wants to catch little ostriches. He says, but why? He says, well, it has to feed its own chicks. And the ostrich then says, but do those birds hate us? They want to catch us? And she says, no, my boy, they don't. They also have chicks to feed. He says, do they eat meat? Yes, unfortunately, says the mother. She says, but why? The felt is full of food for everybody, says the ostrich. Yes, I know, she says, but they don't know it. They close their eyes to change. They think all food has to be meat. And then this ostrich starts thinking, says, there's so much I don't know, Pippin thinks. He knows that one day he may have to face an eagle, but he's not going to live in fear. That is too small a world to live in. No, light has to shine in all the time, and fear steals your light. He's not that type of ostrich. Now, we all know the idea of an ostrich that puts its head under the sand. He's not that type of ostrich. So he's going to be different. And he decides he's one day going to become a teacher, and he's going to teach eagles that there's a whole world of food beyond meat. Now, what a lofty thought. Now, that, I must say, that thought was sparked by me eating a burger made of something which had no meat in it, and it was the most delicious thing I thought I'd ever eaten. A whole world of food beyond meat. We definitely not plug trademarks.
Right.
Yeah, so that was just a flight of fancy, but it sort of gives this little ostrich a focus, right, something he wants to do in future, and gives direction. And things like thoughts can give life direction to children.
So true. There are some parents who may not know how to broach a subject. Why would your books open a door for them to do so?
I think the book is, because it is layered, there are themes in it which a parent would say, well, I'm uncomfortable talking about this. I don't know whether this is something that I can really deal with. It's too complex. Let me give you an example. There's one story where it's called the chessboard gives a sigh. Now, a chessboard can't give a sigh, but this one does. And why does it sigh? Because it can only experience two dimensions, forward and backward and sideways. But it knows there's a game being played on top of it. But it can't be part of it because it's in another dimension. So he's longing to be exposed to a dimension that it can feel and knows it's there. So there's more than what I know. And I want to be part of it. So the chessboard is now on a quest to discover another dimension. In walks a little boy, and a teacher tries to teach him chess. And he says that I'm going to raise your game to another dimension. Same word, different context. And he means it in the sense I'm going to raise your strategy. And he tries to teach this child how to counter an attack. He realizes that his queen is under attack and he makes a plan to thwart him. And the wise man says to him, I see you understand already the concept of strategy. That's a new dimension that I'm teaching you. The boy says, I know that word. My grandfather has it. He says, no, that's another word. It's not dimension. That's dementia. It's something different. It's not this word. I'm teaching you to lift your game. And then the boy loses the game and he's very crestfallen. And the man says, but you mustn't be sad because you played well. And giving your best is good enough. It might not yet be good enough to win, but you're getting there. Just give your best. And that triggers something in the boy to say that they have to emigrate because his father has lost his job. So wow. Yeah. The wise man says, no, but now I have to teach this child something new. And he takes him to a very old picture of a chess game. It's a well-known painting of a chess master playing against the devil. And he says, should I be watching this? And the man says to him, look at the chessboard. And the boy looks at the chessboard and he says, but the devil's going to win. I don't want to see this. And the man says to him, look at the king on the chessboard. And the boy realizes that the queen might be sacrificed.
Thank you for listening to All Roads 65 Max Radio with Pamela Henderson. Join us every other week on Tuesdays, 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on BBS Radio Station 1. And please visit allroads65max.org and become a volunteer or sponsor and be the change you want to see in this world. With your help, we can make a difference in our society and uplift those who so desperately need our help. Thank you for tuning in.